Victim is in her late 30s, professional person going by her clothes and guessing something in the media, going by the frankly alarming shade of pink. Travelled from Cardiff today, intending to stay in London for one night. It's obvious from the size of her suitcase.
Suitcase?
Suitcase, yes. She's been married for at least 10 years, but not happily. She's had a string of lovers, but none of them knew she was married.
Oh, for God's sake, if you're just making this up...
Everybody, welcome to the Brick Pit, your premier podcast for uninformed information and conjecture in the world of television and film. I am one of your hosts, Josh, and with me, as usual, is the man who knew the man who knew too much, Adam.
Hello.
And the man who stole the man's shoe that had one red shoe, Jason.
Wow, that was a long way to go for nowhere.
It was a lot of squeeze for a little juice. that's my MO. If you're not going to take your time, then you might as well not get the small jokes out there.
It's like a Hanna-Barbera cartoon where they're walking and it's just the same background the whole time.
Yeah, we recycle my animations a lot. just color them different so I'm Baloo in one and then I'm, whoever, Pooh Bear.
Oh, now we can't broadcast in China. Thanks a lot, Josh.
That had nothing to do with today's episode. Where we're going to talk about the everyday investigator. It's a trope that is been around for quite some time, and it's different than like the police procedural or like a police investigation, because it typically the original trope was more or less you could go back to Sherlock Holmes or like Dashiell Hammett and the kind of PI. But it also bleeds into like, you've got a medical examiner or like just a photographer, just random people that get involved in some kind of mystery or typically murder or kidnapping plot, something outside their depth. So it's the everyman confronted with conspiracy and having to employ the tactics of basically the police to solve the mystery.
Agatha Christie's Miss Marple.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
They're Encyclopedia Brown.
He was a fraud, by the way.
So, the three investigators, which is Encyclopedia Brown's better version. I don't know if you've ever heard of the Three Investigators books.
Is that something you wrote? Like,
it's not. They were actually marketed as Alfred Hitchcock's The Three Investigators, and they were a series of paperbacks in the 60s and 70s. They were all ghostwritten, of course. The actual author was Robert Arthur was his name, but they are really, really good. They're hard to find. The originals are.
They were so good but that they're hard to find.
They are this weirdly enough, they're super big in Germany.
Are you saying you'd have to go on an investigative quest to find?
That's right. But
you're
anyway,
a rare bookseller.
The protagonist was a 12-year-old overweight boy named Jupiter Jones, who lived at his uncle's junkyard. And he had two friends who were his like version of Watson that helped him solve mysteries for Alfred Hitchcock.
That actually sounds pretty interesting.
It was my favorite book as a kid.
I was a Hardy Boys kid. Like in elementary school, I read all the Hardy Boys books.
Yeah.
I guess that reminds me real quick of one of my favorite Frasier jokes, which is whenever Frasier and Niles are going to write a series of young mystery novels about the two young Crane boys, and he goes, like the Hardy Boys or Nancy Drew, and Roz goes, so you're gonna name it the Nancy Boys. Anyway, sorry.
I bet that joke played well on television by a professional actress with comedic timing. That sounds like something that could have been funny.
I would say going to the Hardy Boys because I think I've mentioned this before. Like when I started reading them in the late 80s, like they had done this Splinter series where they kind of aged them up as to like 18, 19 years old.
And they got them prostitution.
Yes. No, yes. They got into like international espionage and, you know, rode motorcycles and went to Europe and
that was the 80s.
Yeah.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, it was just missing the bags of cocaine. That was the only thing they were missing out of them.
So yeah, I mean, Scooby-Doo. I mean, we yeah. kinda, you know, we've all grown up on this kind of stuff, but it's a pretty tried and true literary device. You know, Alfred Hitchcock was very big on the everyman. Edgar Allan Poe had, I can't remember his name, but he had like
a French detective. Yeah.
Yeah. So and then you've got Sherlock Holmes and, like I said, Miss Marple. So
Hercule Poirot.
Yeah.
Which was actually he was just a Belgian police officer, but he was always on vacation and getting into murders.
It's like Murder, She Wrote.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, just couldn't get away from murder.
The highest per capita murder rate in the country is that little town she lives in.
What's funny is my youngest daughter got super into Murder, She Wrote for a while. And it's like, I was just impressed. I think it had like 600 episodes or something crazy. Like how many ways they could get her into a murder situation. She inherited like an estate in England so they could get her to England to right. solve some murders.
It
really shot her into space that time.
Space Murder was really good. That was a two-parter. Hulk Hogan was like the special guest. It was really weird. He didn't sell that either. What do you guys think is what makes it different than the kind of police driven narratives, and what draws you to that genre, if at all? If you don't even like the genre, why not?
Like I said, we grew up with, you know, the 80s and 70s especially had a lot of this on television. Magnum PI, Rockford Files, you know, we've already mentioned Murder, She Wrote. But mystery is this great genre that you can kind of plug into to almost anything. And there's something different with someone who doesn't have a badge and a gun who can get into just about as much trouble as the people that they're investigating and trying to bring down.
Right. They can work outside the system.
Yeah. And, just that, but, you know, there's greater consequences for what they do than it is for a police officer.
Yeah, because oftentimes the police are almost like a secondary antagonist to the protagonist. They're a stumbling block, or they're getting in the way of the person finding the truth. That's
at times, you know, it can be the fact that the police suspect the protagonist as being the murderer, right, or whatever. You know, that's mm-hmm. a big thing as well. I remember seeing a ways back a website that was talking about it made a very good observation in the fact that mysteries, especially film noir and espionage movies, have a lot in common, because in those movies, the protagonist has to figure out this mystery because their life is on the line.
That's an interesting point. Yeah, you're right that a lot of times it is the protagonist is the main suspect. And so they have no choice but to unravel the mystery lest they be blamed for it. That's a good point. It's interesting, too, how the portrayals of these characters have changed over the years. You started with the hard-boiled detective, and that kind of rolled into, eventually, Magnum P.I., which was not exactly Sam Spade. You know?
Well, Magnum P.I. Yeah. is definitely the spiritual successor to Jim Rockford.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Rockford was definitely a step in that evolution. I mean, there's not a whole lot of personality-wise between the two. Is the mustache makes the difference.
Yeah. Well, there's an interesting story. Tom Selleck actually was a big fan of James Garner and was on one of the later season episodes of The Rockford File as like another PI, but he was, you know, wore a suit and everything. Mm-hmm. Sat James Garner down, was talking to him, said, listen, you know, the network wants me to do this TV show. It's in Hawaii, and it's called Magnum PI, and I don't want to do it. And Garner told him, like, I can't give you any advice. All I can tell you is that you will never have any more power than what you have right now. So if you can't do anything about it now, you won't be able to do anything about it later. Selleck called his manager. His manager called the studio and said, we're not going to do it. Belisario, who was producing and creating the show, went over to Selleck's house and sat down and talked to him, and they reworked the entire premise of the show. And so that, I think that's kind of how you got a lot of that a little bit of Jim Rockford in there.
Yeah. And that's why we don't have Tom Selleck as Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
Which I'm totally fine. I think that worked out fine for everybody.
That's right.
Everyone involved, yeah.
I was not affected adversely by those decisions, so that's all I really care about.
I know this won't make any sense, but every time I hear Magnum P.I., I think of Kolchak, the Night Stalker. Kolchak, Night Stalker. And I have to make that mental
correction. That's a good one. I'm actually kind of mad I didn't put that on my list, Matt.
There. Yeah, Kolchak was amazing because it added the supernatural element.
Right.
Yeah. So
basically, it's all the same beats as the Everyday Investigator, except vampires and werewolves,
right?
Which is like,
I love the fact he's also part of this, like, just low, almost tabloid-esque,
right,
syndicate. And he keeps going out and doing all these, oh, there's vampires and, you know, Las Vegas or whatever. And it's just like, no, do the story we told you to do.
I think my favorite thing about that is, like, it was, you know, it was only one season and it was a total failure, right? It bombed. But in syndication is where it really succeeded. Yeah. And I think, I mean, I can't speak for you necessarily, but for me, it primed me that when the X-Files debuted, I was already like zoned in for that kind of entertainment. I was like, oh, this is
good. Yeah. There's no way that the X-Files wasn't informed by Kolchak.
Sure. I mean,
it was a season and it was also a TV movie because they reworked.
Yeah, that's right.
The TV movie was the vampires in Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. And then for the TV show, I think they put it in Chicago or something like that.
Yeah. And I love how schlubby he was, you know?
Yeah.
he was literally like, oh, man, damn vampires. I got a story to write. I got these vampires. He was like eternally put off by the supernatural. It wasn't like he was enamored with it. He was like, God, mummies.
Voodoo.
Who knew this voodoo?
I think that's what we didn't even think about is the supernatural investigator.
Yeah.
Sure. You know, yeah. That opens up the can of worms of like, you know,
cast a deadly spell, which I love.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But I mean, just H.P. Lovecraft.
Yeah.
In general. Was like very much, hey, I'm an ordinary dude. I won't go poking around. Oh my God, I'm insane.
We should do that for Halloween next year. This would actually be a good, we should write in our notes for Halloween next year to do.
Oh yeah, well, Jason and I will talk about cast a deadly spell for like 6 hours. Analyze it frame by frame. Because we're like the only two people that have ever watched that movie.
Double feature with that and Remo Williams, The Adventure Begins.
I'll drop off on that. You may be the only Remo Williams fan in existence.
I just love it for how, like, so 80s cheesy it is.
I mean, it's that.
Yes. It's insanity on celluloid.
Yeah. Sometimes in these films and TV shows, it is the private investigator, and then a lot of times you get just the schlub that gets pulled in. But Adam, we haven't heard from you. What's your thought on the genre? And
so, you know, I think origins of all of this, I think in modern culture, is going to be the Sherlock Holmes, Arthur Conan Doyle serials. I think that's the archetype that sets the stage for what I consider to be the primary version of what a PI should be, a private investigator should be, because the essential elements for a good one for me are the flawed detective. The main guy is screwed up somehow. He's got a loyal, very smart, capable sidekick who does a lot of the legwork too, or poor old sidekicks in some cases. But I think one of the things that I really like, what makes a good PI for me is your main guy is flawed in such a way that sometimes his own intelligence is the stumbling block. Like the thing that gets in his own way is he knows too much, or he lacks social graces or whatever.
Right. So like Holmes, I think he's like one of the most portrayed characters.
He is the most, according to Wikipedia anyway. Yeah.
Well, I mean, who knows if that holds true now?
Yeah.
When was that Wikipedia article written? When was your Encyclopedia Brown delivered? But he's also the most misrepresented up until very recently.
There's a lot of bad Sherlock Holmes stuff.
Yes. Well, and there's a lot of, it's kind of like the Captain Kirk thing. There's a lot of like Sherlock Holmes that is put on screen that's based on what people think Sherlock Holmes is and have never read Sherlock Holmes. Because I thought the guy, Richie Sherlock Holmes, was actually pretty darn faithful. Sherlock Holmes could fight and could shoot. Mm-hmm. He was drug addled when he wasn't working. So like those films, I thought worked very well and were very true to the books, more so than like the Basil Rathbone.
Yeah, yeah. No, 100%. I think
did Robert you hear Downey, that, Adam? Yeah. He liked Guy Ritchie.
He likes Guy Ritchie. That's what I heard. Everything Guy Ritchie has ever made is so good. Josh can't stand to even think about it. It's just, it hurts him. It's too glorious to look at, is what it is.
Yes. It burns my eyes.
I agree. Actually, of the recent stuff, so the Robert Downey Jr. portrayals, there's what, two or three of them now? I think there's at least two, there's a third one coming out. But they're easy to watch. The liberties that they take with stories and plots are reasonable. I've watched a ton of the Sherlock Holmes adaptations and all of the different like variety of things. And I have several that I love and lots that I don't. In fact, that was one of the things, I mean, we can go ahead and talk about it now, I guess, since we're already in it. But the thing, like, for example, the Enola Holmes.
Now, where to begin? My mother named me Enola, which backwards spells alone. And yet, we were always together. And it was wonderful. She was my whole world. Which leads me onto the second thing you need to know. A week ago, I awoke.
Mother?
To find that my mother was missing, and she did not return.
I'm presently on the way to collect my brothers, Mycroft and Sherlock.
Yes, Sherlock Holmes, the famous detective, my genius brother. He will have all the answers.
Enola.
The Netflix series that they've stolen elements of the stories, but they're essentially making them with Millie Bobby Brown. Mm-hmm. As his sister,
as the non-existent sister.
So it's
which actually comes from a series of books, I believe.
Right. Yeah. That's what I would say about that. Is I think those are both very, even though they're loosely based, they treat the stories that they do present in what I would consider to be a faithful way to the way Holmes is written by Arthur Conan Doyle. Which is the twists make sense. The plot revelations are, it's hard to judge any kind of, so, you know, everything comes back to the source material. And what's wild is the way Arthur Conan Doyle published these was through a magazine, a mystery magazine in London called The Strand. And they came out in serial form. So there would be, even though they were short stories, they would sometimes be, you know, three or four pages weekly or monthly. And he would build on it. And for us, because we've seen so much media that builds on these storylines, they seem very predictable. If you watched a true to the story film, or even sometimes you'll see these, because a lot of them have fallen out of copyright. That's why we have so many versions of these.
Right.
Like you'll sometimes see like community theaters put on a Holmes story as a play. And if you've never read the story, it's super predictable. Like, oh, I know exactly like within minutes who the bad guy is and what's going to happen. But at the time, the way that Arthur Conan Doyle presented these twists, it was novel and strange and unique to the reader. To do that in today's modern with like the Enola Holmes, it takes a lot of work to like put in a new thing. Having said all that, Enola Holmes is very predictable, right? You know exactly how it's going to end. Right. Even with the new one, you watch, you're like, oh, but it's in a fun and almost like comfort food way, right? Like, I guess that's the way I put it.
I like the first season and a half of Cumberbatch's performance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The first season especially was like probably one of the best modern updating of a tale, because the stories were essentially
the same.
Pulled in today, and the way that they added modern technology and stuff made sense. It didn't violate the spirit of the story, and his portrayal was great. And then by the end of it, it got really bad. And it was one of those things, like the more popular it got, the more it latched onto like the kind of tropey and like pop culture-y things instead of like the source material. And the worse the show got, in my opinion.
There's also the escalation. Like they kept building up more and more, so you'd have to have bigger payoffs. And oh, look, he's dead, but he's not dead.
Yeah,
which I know they're mimicking happened in the stories, because Doyle killed off Sherlock Holmes because he didn't want to write him anymore.
Right. And then Mehdi brought him
like,
back.
Yeah, he's like, hey, here's all this money you're missing out on. Yeah. So, okay, I'll bring him back.
His wife was like, boy, that Sherlock Holmes sure did pay for lights. The end of the BBC Sherlock just got so... When he like literally shoots the Rupert Murdoch insert in the head, I was like, that is the most on the nose thing I've ever seen on television in my life. He should have just looked at the camera and said, This is Rupert Murdoch and this is what we think of him. Bam.
But so speaking of looking at the camera, I think the Enola Holmes, breaking the fourth wall, I usually really hate that. I almost always find that obnoxious. In the first one, it's very minimal. In the second one, they pile it on a little bit more. But it's a rare instance where I think that the director did okay. And it's not egregious. And it's almost always in service to the story in a way that actually moves the story forward a little bit. Mm-hmm. I was really pleasantly surprised at how much I like both of those movies, honestly. Like, I was going, maybe that's why my expectations were so low.
Some other good examples of adaptations of Holmes is our good friend who wrote The Wrath of Khan and directed it. Also, God, my brain's frying.
Jason, Nicholas Meyers.
He wrote a film called The 7% Solution that really explored the, or at least brought to the forefront the addiction aspect of Holmes' personality. And
he gets treated by Freud in that, right?
Yeah. Really underrated film. And from that, almost a remake, is one of my favorite films called The Zero Effect.
You're probably the best.
Excuse me. You are the best
private investigator in the world.
Two shots, down she goes, execution style. Guess what the victim's name is?
Let me guess.
No, I don't mean really guess. There's no way you can actually guess.
Clarissa.
I'm being blackmailed, Mr. Arlo.
How desperate? Scale of 1 to 10.
Bordering on manic.
I need the matter resolved.
Take me to the scene of the crime.
My employer is hardly your typical private detective.
What did I tell you about the curtains?
When he's working, smoothest operator you've ever seen. Brave, slick, cunning. As soon as he gets off work, complete freak, nuts, tactless, terrible, rude.
Hello?
What's his name?
Harold Burgess.
Mitchell
Hudwell. Nick Carmine.
Daryl.
Sergio.
I'll give you $1 million if you sell out your boss.
When your number's up, it's up.
$2 million.
Innocent people suffer, and murderers get away with it.
$5 million.
What kind of a hold does this guy, whoever he is, have on you?
These people are victims of plots, and they need our help.
So what if I was to walk in there right now? What would happen?
I'll shoot you. I have a gun and everything.
The mysterious and brilliant Daryl Zero.
Can I ask you a question?
What's that?
Why are we talking on the phone?
Which has Bill Pullman as Daryl Zero. And he is basically the Holmes analog, and Ben Stiller is his Watson. And it is up until like the BBC Holmes and the Guy Ritchie film, to me, it was the best, truest adaptation of Sherlock Holmes, and it was in modern times. I mean, it was, now it's a period piece because it took place in the 90s, but at the time it was hip and with it.
So another aspect of it that's in the same Holmes universe, it's like Shakespeare. There's so many like recreations and adaptations and homages or whatever. And one of them, the famous one, I think most people would come to right in mind, is Dr. House MD, or House MD is the name of the show, right? And it's,
I don't know, man. You tell me.
House MD, you know, with Hugh Laurie in it. And
Dr. House MD, medical doctor.
That's right. Medical doctor of doctoring. Because the creators started it with a deliberate attempt to do all of these like Easter eggs back to Sherlock Holmes. If you are a huge Sherlock Holmes fan and you watch for them, I know you typically hate that kind of crap, but I love it.
I ate it up
when it happened in real time.
I like anything that's done well.
Yeah, I thought it was done well. Things
like my steaks with ketchup.
Things tend to degrade over seasons, right? Mm-hmm. The joke wears thin, but the early seasons, his Watson is named Wilson and houses mm-hmm. Holmes and whatever. Just this little hints of things, and he's addicted to Vicodin and Holmes was addicted, you know, those little things are all very clever. But there's a lot of other Easter eggs throughout the episodes like that. The medical mysteries they solve are throwbacks to other mysteries in the novels in a very, very clever way and a very subtle. That's the thing that really I liked about it was that if you didn't know, if you'd never heard of Sherlock Holmes in your life and you watched these just as medical dramas, you would think they were great. But if you liked the investigator aspects of it, the thing that fascinated me, I loved them. So as far as, I guess it's a homage, I guess that would be my favorite.
I don't think that you'll find anybody in the brick pit that didn't like House, man.
there's a lot of hate out there.
Well, my problem with it is,
I stand corrected.
No, I like the first season, but my problem with it is exactly what Josh has said before. It's not necessarily the show itself, it's the fans. Because there were so many people coming out of the woodwork is like, oh, look at House. This means I can be a complete and utter jerk because I'm smart. It's like, one, you're not that smart.
It's not lupus.
Right. Two, no.
Save my life first. Then you can talk to me like that. You know, just not out the box.
Those are the ones I really wanted to hit.
The House, I didn't think about adding that, but that's a pretty good adaptation. I don't know. I can't speak highly enough about the Zero Effect. Of course, it's not streaming anywhere.
No.
Because it's good.
it really is. It's a fantastic film.
I saw it when it came out, and I was like a teenager, and like, you know, I didn't know it, you know, anything. And I was like, this seems smart. This make brain hurt.
Make brain hurt. I will say, I think of all the adaptations, the ones I like, the Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce, you know, the ones they did in BBC back in the, I don't know, old, a long time ago, very old.
A century ago.
Almost. Looks like early 30s.
Century,
yeah, it was like 1931 was the first Basil Rathbone. So we're getting close to 100 years later. The Calabash Pipe and the Deerstalker Cap aren't necessarily from the books. Like our image of that comes from those Basil Rathbone adaptations.
Interesting. Well, yeah, a lot of stuff comes from the adaptations, you know, Tarzan swinging from the vine and the yelling.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Superman flying and all that stuff comes from other media. What I like also is that Holmes is most adapted, but he's almost like satirized. At least I remember it as being funny. I haven't seen it in so long. Without a Clue with Michael Caine and Ben Kingsley.
Oh, yeah.
Caine is Sherlock, Kingsley is Watson. And the twist on that is that Watson is actually the genius investigator.
Mm-hmm.
And Holmes is kind of this figurehead that he uses for his stories.
I haven't even thought about that.
Oh, that's
great movie.
It is.
Yeah.
And that almost has become a trope in and of itself, as like the sidekick being the real
hero.
Yeah,
good call, man. So, but that brings up the point of what's interesting about like this kind of milieu, or whatever you want to call it, this kind of setup, is it's not necessarily genre defined. It can be part of so many different types of genre. You have like future noir kind of stuff, and then you've got comedy, and then just thriller and cosmic horror. But
and I'll also say, like, film noir is a very specific type of mystery, PI type films, which I would love to do an episode just of that by itself, because there's so many great examples.
Yes. No, we'll never mention Dick Tracy on this show in any iteration.
At least not those words together in that form.
I cannot tell you the depths of my loathing of Dick Tracy in all of his forms. Warren Beatty being like the penultimate manifestation of the worstness
Right, so real fast, I really don't know anything about any of the television or film adaptations of it. My grandfather had the comic books that I read when I was a kid, maybe. I mean, I don't remember them that well, but why? What am I missing?
One, the comic strips are very important because they influence a lot of stuff coming on, like Batman.
Yeah.
Especially the Rogues Gallery.
I could see that, yeah. That,
the grotesqueness of the Rogues Gallery comes from Dick Tracy. The Warren Beatty movie, what, like 88? 89, 90, somewhere around there.
It was post Batman,
so probably 90 then.
Yeah,
no, I think. Well, it, Batman's yeah. 89, so
yeah.
The next so. But it's not really that good. It's a vanity project from Warren Beatty, and at the same time, in order to promote that, they pulled up like all the old cartoons from the 60s that are terribly racist. I mean, I can't even begin to explain how racist.
Oh no, please do.
These
explain.
60s cartoons are.
They're 60s cartoons of a guy named Dick Tracy.
They would do like these side episodes where he relied on like other agents under him, and they were always just like extremely stereotypical. A Mexican, I can't even remember the name of it. There was a Mexican character.
It's not.
Of course, the yeah. poncho and the sombrero.
Right.
And it was a Chinese character, so it was the buck teeth. And, you know, it was horrible. It was like as a 10-year-old, I'm cringing.
That can't be why Josh doesn't like it.
Even look,
well, no, Josh just hates things.
It was so racist that Johnny Quest said, "Hey, maybe this is a little."
Let's step back a little bit,
Haji. What do you think about?
Oh, this? Man, this I hadn't thought about Johnny Quest in a hot minute either. That's
60s cartoons were rife with boy, casual racism. Ah, the good old days. That was sarcasm. That was sarcasm.
I don't know if that's better or worse than like the racism that came later, where it's like, let's make up these really good depictions of these minorities and everything. It's like, those are pretty racist depictions of minorities, and you're thinking these are good?
Well, that's a whole nother topic.
So. Google Rickety Rocket. That's all I'm going to tell you.
All right. So while you're doing that, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll come back to dive into some more specifics. And we're back. So let's cut to the chase. Let's talk about some specific movies. I know we've mentioned some, but let's go into great excruciating detail about things we like. That's where the money is. That's what we bring to the table. Long, excruciating, detailed plot synopsises and gushing over things
shot by like. Shot analyses of things only two or three people have ever seen.
So let's start with Jason.
All right. What you got? I'm gonna start with one that came out when I was about 10 years old. Lady in White.
It's 1962. It's Halloween.
I wish I was as weird as you. Thanks.
There's nothing wrong with the town of Willow Point Falls that a powerful imagination can't cure.
The London Bridge crumpled under the monster's huge lizard feet. That's impossible. Or is it?
But this time, it's not make-believe.
No, don't hurt him. It was too dark. I couldn't see his face.
This time, it's serious, deadly serious.
I'm telling you, that doesn't matter. This case has been making monkeys out of all of us for the past 10 years.
And strange, very strange, for you have seen a girl.
There was a little girl. I saw her. She was killed in the cloakroom.
A girl who wants you to find her killer.
Will you help me?
You have just one hope to solve the mystery.
Sometimes when someone dies violent, they can't rest in peace.
To stop the evil.
Where are you going? I gotta follow her.
To save your life.
Come here, child.
Open the door.
Your prayers. Lady in White.
What I like about it is the main character is actually a kid. The concept of it is that he returns to his hometown as an adult, and he's a writer. They hint at that he specializes in essentially like horror or ghost stories and stuff like that. Apparently, you can take a taxi from New York City to some quaint upstate New York town. So that's what he does. And the cab driver asks him, he recognizes him, asks him, do you believe in that stuff? And so that sends a flashback. He talks about growing up when he was 10. So this is like the early 60s. It's a ghost story. He winds up getting locked in his school at night by bullies. He witnesses a ghost of a little girl. And he sees her being murdered. But all he can see is her spirit. But she's reenacting her murder. And then the murder shows up because they're going to replace the furnace. And apparently there's some evidence that was lost and fell into a grate. So the movie takes place over actually several months. It starts in Halloween and ends around Christmas. But there's a lot of stuff. Like, this was a kid's movie when I grew up. Mm-hmm. And so for like the late 80s, yeah, this is a late 80s kid's movie. It is not a modern day kid's movie. Because they first
these
suspect
days are too soft.
No, they first suspect like the janitor, because he was like passed out drunk in the basement, that he attacked the main character instead of the actual killer, and he's black. Even though the father doesn't believe this guy's done, he's talked to the sheriff, and the sheriff's like, "Listen, he's black, and he's as good a scapegoat as anybody else." After a while, he's actually let loose because they don't have any actual evidence. And the mother of one of the kids, because there's actually like a series of child disappearances, which is another aspect that they go into that would not go in a 10-year-old kid movie today. And so she really thinks he's done it. So when he's released, she shoots him. And like that's the end of the Beast plot is murder.
What a delightful tale. Thank you for sharing that.
Like I said,
sounds like fun for all ages to me.
Like I said, that was a kid's movie in the late 80s.
Oh, yeah. It's like when we talked about Cloak and Dagger
a
couple weeks ago. That was ostensibly a kid's movie, and it is the only reason it's a kid's movie is because there's a kid in it.
Yeah.
Like, kids can watch this.
Firestarter's a kid's movie. Carrie.
Right. Yeah. Child's Play is a kid's movie. It's got a kid in it.
Chucky.
It's got a toy in it.
Chucky. That's got dolls in it. That's
that's kid stuff.
In fact, it's
got
called
Chris Sarandon in it.
There's a movie called Child's Play. I mean, for goodness sake.
It's right there in the title.
But for the whole family, come see it at the local drive-in.
But yeah, like I said, it's really weird because I went back and watched it. And I remember when I was a kid, like it was a really, it didn't do well at the box office, but it was marketed pretty heavily. It was marketed as a like a kid's ghost story movie. And to go back and watch, it's like, oh yeah, I forget that they used the N-word several times in this movie. Yeah. But yeah, I still think it's worth a watch, though. Just kind of go back because they take an average concept that you use elsewhere in film and literature and all that kind of stuff, but they just make the kid the protagonist.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see it through their eyes, and it's a little bit frightening for a kid.
I like kid detective movies where the kid is the, if you're a parent, you've undoubtedly seen a lot of these, but there's because
Taken.
This, yeah, that's not what I meant, but where the kid is the detective, not the other way around.
Like the investigators.
Yeah.
My kids watch the mess out of the investigators. They solve schoolyard plots in New Zealand or something, like who stole the koala. I don't watch what my kids watch.
There's some better than that, but yes, basically that genre of, you know, kids solving mysteries. I don't know. There's a handful of them. I can't think of any right now, unfortunately, but
there's so many. It's such a rich subgenre that I don't even want to bring up a name of one.
I
don't want to even give an example.
I like them all equally. It's hard to choose.
My brain is full of Lady in White content now. I can't. I have nothing left.
Touche. Well, now that you started, Adam, What is a what's a film that just?
So for me, it's a it's not necessarily a film. It's a another television series, based off of the works of Rex Stout. And I'm actually really glad we're talking about this. Of all the books that I own, my favorite returning over and over again is the books of Rex Stout, which is the Nero Wolfe series that he wrote. It's 33 novels, 41 short stories from 1934 to the mid 70s.
I love you keep bringing back the supernatural. So like a werewolf detective.
This is actually quite different. So Nero Wolfe is, he's a very Sherlock Holmes-esque character. His distinguishing things that makes the story interesting to me anyway, he's massively obese. He basically is an eccentric shut-in in this brownstone in New York. The bit is he never leaves his house. Often he's driven out for some reason or another, and he's just complaining about it constantly or whatever. But he's this massive guy, and he's hugely successful. He's very, very wealthy because of his success as a detective. He's the richest detective in New York, basically.
So he's like Ignatius J. Reilly as a detective?
Except that he has, his Watson is Archie Goodwin, who is this dapper, fit, young ladies' man. This is his, like, number one guy, is in the, you know, helps solve him. And he's not as smart as Wolfe. You know, Nero Wolfe is the mastermind, but Archie's really, really clever and streetwise. And there's a supporting cast of characters. He's got a personal chef, and he's into orchids, and he has orchids on the top floor of his greenhouse. Anyway, the details that Rex Stout writes about him make this very vivid picture in my mind.
Tell me more about these orchids. That is fascinating.
I know you're being facetious, but I will. He is in addition to being a world-class detective, he also is a competition orchid hybrid grower. And he has a full-time gardener on staff to help him grow these orchids on his
side. Adam, when you're reading these books, how do you keep them from catching fire, turning these pages so fast?
And what's also interesting is that his characters never age. Even though they were written from 1934 all the way up to 1975, they're perpetually, I guess Wolf's about late 50s and Archie's in his early 40s or late 30s, and they stay the same age, you know, their ages. But the show, and there's been dozens, almost as many as Holmes, there's been dozens of radio adaptations, because these came out contemporaneously in the 30s, 40s, 50s. And so there was stage plays and film adaptations. There's been several movies. There's already been two different TV shows. But the one I want to talk about is the 2001 A&E show, Nero Wolfe, which you can get on DVD still. Excellent. It's, I think there's 12 episodes, maybe 15. Actually, it says 20 here. So one of the best TV shows I've ever seen. I absolutely love it. Still ranks very, very, very highly for me. Really true to the books. And in the show, Mari Chaikin plays Nero Wolfe, and he does a fantastic job. Timothy Hutton is Archie, as the sidekick. Over the series, the run of the series, they use the same cast to play different characters in each episode. So the supporting cast will be somebody that, you get the idea. Anyway, one of the very, very best shows. I highly recommend both the books and that specific adaptation of it. Both of those forms of media, best show, best books ever. And so I'm really glad I got to talk about it, even though not very many people have seen it. So there you go. That's why we started the podcast.
I think the TV show was pretty popular.
It only had two seasons. One of the like handful of things. I can name a few, like the Nero Wolfe TV show, Blade Runner, the movie, The West Wing are a few things that I could just watch over and over and over again on repeat. And they always bring me joy. And so if you've heard me describe other things in this podcast, you're like, oh, I like that too. I would really highly encourage you to go track this down and give it a shot because it's great. So
I would rewatch over and over again Christmas commercial of Santa slaying around in the Norelco. I watched that over and over.
My only comment is if I wanted to watch a fat guy that didn't want to leave his house, I would look in the mirror.
I will say that there is definitely an element of seeing myself in the character. Because the other thing of his character is that he's a gourmand, and his other full-time staff is this French chef that he brings in. And he's very, very particular about the way his food's cooked.
3.5 pounds of venison. you put more than 3 juniper berries in the marinade would be overwhelming.
No, sir. Venison requires a strong arm.
Would you turn the main course into dessert?
No. I have picked these berries myself. They are ripe, but not ripe enough. Therefore, they are not sweet. Therefore, you must use 5 berries at least.
Give me one of them. Let me taste it fresh. It'll ruin my anticipation of the meal. It's better than a ruined meal.
And the way recipes are, you know, they must be specific. He also has a button on his desk. And anytime he presses it, Fritz, his cook, will bring him a bottle of beer, which I think would be a nice thing to have. He has this huge library. He spends all of his time reading and trying to avoid getting new jobs.
The modern Nero Wolf just sits on Reddit all day trying to solve international mysteries.
Cold cases on.
Who is eating the babies in Washington, D.C.?
He's very involved in QAnon.
This all just sounds like a ripoff of Jake and the Fat Man.
Anyway,
that's it, maybe.
Well, this started in 1934. That was when the first book came out.
Well, the Jake and the Fat Man is immortal, so
that's true. They are timeless. They in the beginning, there was Jake and the Fat Man, and it was good.
they uncovered some ancient text in the Dead Sea. You know, it was an episode of Jake and the Fat Man in Sanskrit.
I was going to say, William Conrad definitely was an immortal.
Womp, womp. All right, well, I want to talk about a film that it's not necessarily the best film. I think it's interesting and worth noting in this genre. It kind of has a sister film that everyone swears they weren't copying each other, but they're like eerily similar and came out at the same time, but whatever. And that is Brian De Palma's Blowout, starring John Travolta.
It began with a sound that no one was ever supposed to hear.
He's one of us all?
Yes, he says he pulled a girl out of the car.
I would like you to forget about her.
That's what I heard just before the tire blew out. You're right, it was a shot.
He recorded a murder. They say it never happened.
There's still loose ends, witnesses. The girl, I've decided to terminate her. Terminate her. Terminate her.
Brian De Palma's Blowout. Now you hear it. Now you don't.
John Travolta is a sound guy in film. And he records a car accident in the background. And it's like the senator or something that dies. And he keeps listening to the audio and trying to decipher what it's all about. He finds out that there's like he can hear a gunshot. And so then he's like, oh, my God, this guy was, you know, this is a setup. He was murdered. And then there's all the political intrigue and people trying to get the audio reels and stuff. But it's a visually very interesting film. It's one of De Palma's better films, one of his earlier films. And Travolta does a really good job. I just really like the concept and the execution. The other film, I think it was Blow Up. Well, the guy was a photographer. Same thing, except he takes a picture and he blows it up and he's like, oh my God, there's a gun. I mean, it's nearly identical plot.
I think De Palma actually kind of lifted it and altered it from that, because it's about 14 years older. And that's something that De Palma does a lot. Dress to Kill is very much his psycho.
Fair enough.
But yeah, I think it's Blow Up, I believe, is probably an Italian film.
I swear that there was a more contemporary film that came out that might have been a remake of it or something that was closer in time of when Blowout came out. But I could be wrong. I'm often wrong.
Oh, yes.
So yeah, Blow Up was 66, I think, and I think it was Italian, you're right. But I'm thinking the one it had Gene Hackman in it, though.
You're thinking The Conversation. That's from maybe. That's early 70s, and that's
we're getting closer, Coppola, at least.
Yeah. Where he's a surveillance specialist, essentially records people's conversations.
Yeah, there's Michael Caine in that as well.
Harrison Ford and Cindy Williams are in it.
Oh, you know, I think of FX.
Which Michael Caine is not in either.
Jesus Christ, we've gone off quality radio here, boys.
just cut it all out. I'm wrong. Oh, I'm sure it will, because Jason's editing this episode. He's just going to edit in all my mistakes taken from prior episodes.
I'm not going to edit in. I'm just not going to edit it out.
But anyway, I think it's a worthwhile film just because it's an interesting concept and it's executed well. I
also kind of leave it out. I think one of the best aspects of it, because the film starts, he's working on like a slasher film.
Right? Oh, yeah.
And they're trying to get like the great scream for the woman as she's getting killed in the shower. In the end, he winds up using his love interest's voice because he had her up and everything, winds up getting killed and screams as she dies, and he winds up using her scream for the film, and like that's the end of it.
That's is a very good point, Mr. Jason.
Now you've got me mixed up. The one that's about the audio, the De Palma movie. I forgot. Mm-hmm.
We mentioned two.
yeah, but now again, I'm full of the lady in white.
John Travolta.
Content. I can't. John Lithgow's in that one, right? He's also in the audio one, right?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay. So.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. He's the bad guy, right? He's
yep.
The, okay.
Yep.
I haven't seen the. I don't think I've seen Blow Up. At least that your description of it doesn't jog my memory, but. Thing I think I remember about the Blowout movie was that it was the first time the reason I remember John Lithgow is because he plays crazy really well. I kind of, every time I see him, I always kind of remember that character of him being kind of evil. If that makes sense. Maybe I'm misremembering that.
Every time I watch Third Rock from the Sun, I
see an evil killer. John, yeah, literally. I mean, I always, yeah, doesn't he play a bad guy in Dexter too, if I remember correctly, John Lithgow?
Isn't he like Dexter's crazy psychopathic dad or something? Or
something like
he's,
that.
He's yeah. A rival serial killer or something.
Right, that's it, yeah. So
because Miami's got so many serial killers.
Murder, She Wrote, should go down there and solve those mysteries, man. Angela
that Lansbury. That would be a crossover of the ages, man. Murder, She Wrote versus Dexter.
Oh, man. We missed opportunity. Poor Angela
Lansbury. From the director of Saul.
Produced by Michael Bay.
We're bringing movies back. Everyone's going to the theater now. Yeah, De Palma's one of those guys that, like, I don't know how I feel about him overall, because he's very hit or miss. But when he's good,
he's great.
He's great. Yeah, I mean, like, The Untouchables is a masterpiece. It's like it's an elevated popcorn film. You know, it may not be historically accurate and all, but he cribs a lot of better filmmakers in a pastiche that works.
Yeah. That's my problem with De Palma too, is because he does do great stuff, but there's that Quentin Tarantino aspect of it. You know, he's
mm-hmm.
he's very yeah. much the film geek who's cribbing from other people.
He's less obnoxious about it though.
Yeah.
And that may just be because of the time. Like, he wasn't on television and everywhere telling people how smart he is and cribbing information, you know, like, oh, and I watched this 1932 film. And
I'm going to tell you, I'm kidding you not, I just was trying to reorient myself about the movies, and I looked up the wiki on Blowout, and the opening section, it says Quentin Tarantino praises De Palma as the greatest director of his generation and cites this as one of his favorite films that he would take to a desert island. I kid you not. That's funny.
I wouldn't praise it that much, but it's certainly, it's worth a watch. And if you're a movie buff and you haven't seen it, you need to see it, because it is a very inside baseball kind of like insider's view of filmmaking in the context of this kind of everyman in an investigation. Jason, what else you got?
Well, I want to go kind of old school to a pre-code film based off the Dashiell Hammett novel, very loosely based, but The Thin Man. There's actually a series of these that came out because of how great the first one is. And I think Roger Ebert even considers it one of the greatest movies of all time. The concept is that William Powell plays a kept husband, essentially. He's like a former detective, and his wife's family is extremely rich, and his wife's Myrna Loy. He loves being just like a rich, kept husband. He loves drinking. And this is especially considered, this is like 34, so I think Prohibition is just about to end when all this happened. But they have great chemistry together, and they're kind of going back and forth, and there's a lot of improvisation, actually, in this film, which is very unusual for the time. But the whole concept is Myrna Loy's character, she, Nora Charles, and he's Nick Charles, but she also kind of loves the fact that he was this detective. He was this great, brilliant detective. And she kind of tries to push him into these mysteries all throughout the series of the film. And the first one is this scientist went out for a walk one night and disappeared, and he's the titular Thin Man. But it's a fantastic film. I really love how... Like the writers, when they started adapting it, they were told just to very loosely adapt it on the story and to mostly kind of key it in on the chemistry between Powell and Loy. It's very fast-paced dialogue back and forth, very playful, but you can also see it's not one of those like kind of acidic throwing insults back and forth. They're very much in love and they're very much playing the same game. One of the great points of it is at the end, you of course have the requisite pull all the suspects together in one room and reveal the plot. And it's like the only scene that they actually did several takes. The director didn't like doing take after take. He felt that the actors kind of lost the energy and the spontaneity. But William Powell's like, there's no way I'm going to remember all these lines and keep this plot together in my head as I'm repeating it, because he's having to just do this exposition dump to explain how he came about to who's who. It was a dinner party and they're serving oysters, so they keep bringing back out the same tray of oysters take after take under the hot studio lights. And he said none of the actors ate oysters after that ever again. It's a great film. It's a great series of films that went on into the 40s. And you have a young Dean Stockwell is actually in the last movie as Nick Jr., one of his early roles as a child actor. And I believe it's in the third movie, Shemp Howard shows up. Because one of the recurring jokes of the series is that Nick Charles always winds up running into somebody he put in prison. But
he put Shemp in prison?
Yes. But they all act like he's their best friend. Like there's none like the usual animosity here. There's like, Nick, how you doing?
I've read about this movie, but I've never watched it. Is it funny?
Oh, it's hilarious. It's fantastic. One of the
Did first... you not hear the part about Shemp being in it?
Yeah. He's not in this one, but he's in the later one.
The lighter ones, yeah.
I mean, but, okay. the alcoholism is a big part of it.
That's always hilarious.
Funny. Yeah,
that's
always funny. Like, one of the early jokes they have is, you know, they have a wired-haired terrier named Astra, and Nora is pulling the dog into the hotel that they're staying at in New York. And there's Nick Charles, of course, at the bar.
Madam, I'm very sorry, but no dog.
You cannot
take the dog in there.
I'm not taking him. He's taking me.
Oh! Are you hurt, madam?
Are you hurt, madam?
Oh, women and children first, boys.
Say, what is the score, anyway?
Oh, so it's you he was after.
Hello, sugar.
He's dragged me into every gin mill on the block.
Yeah, I had him out this morning.
Oh, I thought so.
Oh, this is Tommy, my wife.
How are you?
How do you do?
Tommy, I don't usually look like this. I've been Christmas shopping.
Madam, I'm afraid we shall take the dog out.
Oh, it's all right, Joe. It's all right. It's my dog. And my wife.
Well, you might have mentioned me first on the billing.
My thought about The Thin Man is that it was, the plot wasn't meaty enough for me. Because it was The Thin Man. that plays well in the 30s. That was a pre-code joke.
No, I think, like I said, it's a great film. Like I said, Ebert considers it one of the best films ever. And I think what he says about, like, Powell's performance, he says Powell is to dialogue as Fred Astaire is to dance. So
and like I said, I don't get it.
Like I said, Powell and Loy had great chemistry, and they actually became really good friends over the course of the rest of their lives. The fact that when he lost his wife, she was there to help console him and everything. So,
did they ever find her?
That's comedy gold, Josh.
Death is hilarious.
The only way
Josh dies every.
People, oh yeah,
that's Josh dies every
tragedy
podcast.
In a comedy.
Yeah. That's
right. Comedy is when it happens to somebody else.
But yeah, definitely recommend watching the Thin Man movies. I don't know if it still is. I know they had it on HBO Max as part of the Criterion Collection with TCM.
Chances are they don't, because they're taking away all the good stuff.
So. Yeah.
Conversation for another day.
I'll do a hate box on that.
Okay.
I'm just kidding. I would never.
I would never stoop down to do a hate box.
Yeah.
That's slumming it in our podcasting world. That's
I'm the still trying to
the basement.
I'm trying to get off the smell of doing that one several weeks ago. I'm just
Well, you know. You tainted the integrity of the hate box.
I said the story is based off Dashiell Hammett, who actually used his experience as a Pinkerton detective.
Oh, they're gonna say as an alcoholic.
But that too. I think like a lot of his relationship with I can't remember the woman's name, but she was another a playwright, a famous playwright at the time. So a lot of the banter is based off of their back and forth and everything. But it was when Hammett was a union buster for the Pinkertons, because that's what they were doing in the early 20th century.
There ain't nothing funnier than busting up a union.
Except alcoholism and death, I would say.
Well, yeah. This movie had it all.
Childhood leukemia, maybe. I mean, that might be funnier, but only barely.
We'll have to consult Cancer Boy on that. Well, Adam, you got any other films you'd like to talk about?
Nope.
I'm out.
I will say this is one of my favorite genres, but mostly,
I thought of two movies.
But I don't want to spoil it by talking about it.
You didn't let me finish. Mostly for the books. There's a whole bunch of books that I like, but not to say that I don't watch a good PI movie or a good investigation movie or whatever, but. But no, you guys had a lot, so I kind of scaled back a little bit because I saw that you had a lot you want to talk about. So. And I agree with a lot of them, too. So,
well, then I will talk about probably the most recent out of all on our list. It actually came out this year. So in a very rare appearance of a current film, I want to talk about Confess Fletch. This is a reboot. I don't even want to say a reboot. This is taking a Fletch story and filming it with John Hamm as Fletch and not Chevy Chase, which already made it infinitely better. So Fletch is a series of books written in the 70s about a pot-smoking, lazy reporter, basically a Kolchak type. Slept in a van, had an ex-wife. He was always behind on alimony payments. Just schlubby dude that gets involved in mysteries, murder mysteries, and you know, bank heists and stuff like that. And how he, it's very similar in tone to like the Big Lebowski. The Chevy Chase films, like in the books, Fletch, he's an investigative reporter, and he lies about who he is to gain access. And that's typically like he goes in someplace, they say, who are you? And he says, I'm supposed to be here. I'm so-and-so. And they go, okay. And he walks in. He just BS's his way in because that's realistic in that he puts on a jacket, a dinner jacket, and walks into a club and nobody, you know, acts like it's like walking.
That's
in,
tropey too.
Yeah, but it's
Veronica Mars does that a lot in the Veronica Mars show.
Well, Fletch did it first. So it's like it's the concept of like you can go anywhere if you have a ladder.
Yes, like, right. So yeah.
So the Chevy Chase films was let's dial in on this.
It's a Chevy Chase.
Yeah, but it's like it's very like character like each he's going to have all these disguises and it's like that's kind of the movie and it's really I do not like it and it's
I don't like them either. I've always seen one of them. I don't know which.
It's very Jim Carrey-esque kind of comedy. Very
that's interesting.
Real, but it's all contingent on you know. Oh look, I'm gonna like it's more in tune with like Ace Ventura than okay. These books.
That's fair.
So Confess
another Fletch. Another esteemed detective movie we've not talked
yes.
about
for a reason. I like my detectives what make their butt talk. that's highbrow. So here's what this is a really really good adaptation of Fletch. John Hamm and the director both cut their salaries down so they could have a couple additional days in Rome to film. So much they believed in this project. So they really got it. Unfortunately, I think it flopped. and we'll probably never see another Fletch film from John Hamm. And I think that that's terrible. One of the things that really struck me, though, it's a comedy. It's a funny film. But it's a mature film. It's like there are adults in adult situations and not like, you know, oh, adult, you know, but there's no sophomoric humor right. really to it. Like
they're paying bills.
Yes. And it struck me that it was Scorsese or somebody was riffing on MCU because all these directors are bagging on MCU. But one of them said, everybody in these films acts like they're in college. And that struck me because it's like, you know, that's very true. And comedy has really gotten to a point where everything's Judd Apatow kind of sophomore humor. Yeah. And this is the first time in a long time that I can remember a film being like adult comedy, like a comedy where the jokes are smart. The people are talking like the plot revolves around.
What's the difference between what you're describing and highbrow comedy? Because what you're saying to me sounds highbrow, but not. Is it that they're not trying to be smarmy about it, or?
I mean, I don't know what you mean by highbrow. It's not like it's
the opposite of like American Pie, right?
Yeah, this is like somewhere in the middle ground. It's just okay. It's just
you don't have to listen to Bach to watch the movie,
right? But it's not trying to be smarter than it is, but it's not trying to be dumb either. Yeah, right, people make rational choices. What I love about Fletch is typically wrong.
Like, right.
he draws like the, and you're like with him because you're like, yeah, that's probably what happened. It's like, that's not what happened at all. And you're kind of in the way more than you're helping because you're a schlubby pot smoking dude. Let the police do their jobs. One thing that struck me is that they make some, so plot revolves around some stolen art, and Fletch shows up at this place he's staying under false pretenses, and there's a dead body in there. There's this woman that's murdered, so he calls the police like very casually. He's like, "Hey, there's a dead body here," and so of course he's number one suspect. But they're talking about art in the and he has a fairly cogent conversation full of jokes with the police detective about art. And I was like, you know, I know lots of people who are not highbrow or super artistic, but like mm-hmm. when we went to New York City with some friends of ours, they wanted to go to to MoMA because they enjoy going to museums. And even though they're not really, because that's what people do that are adults.
And they can be conversational about it, even if they don't know everything there is to know about
it. And it just was sad to me that I was like, man, I don't know when the last time I've seen a conversation like this on film, especially in terms of a comedy. And so that bit about everybody's acts like they're in college and MCU films really struck home with me. Because I was like, I think that's a very fair criticism on the culture at large. That kind of Apatow sophomore humor is just ever present. And not that it's
Tell us more about how alcoholism is funny.
So when you drink, it's funny because you ruin lives. And ruined lives are funny. It was destined to fail because it didn't aim low. And it didn't aim high. It just aimed at like, hey, like Jason, you pay bills? Fletch is funny.
But Owen is divorced?
Not officially.
Okay.
His ex, Tatiana, she's making it complicated. I don't want to say anything bad about Tatiana, but she's a detestable person. She calls herself a lifestyle curator, a thought leader. What is that?
Not familiar with it.
Owen financed her company. Now she wants to cut him out and she wants full custody of their child.
Huh.
Owen is a good dad. Tatiana really, 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 really sucks. Oh.
Yeah, you got it. You got it right in the thing there. Oops.
I mean, Tatiana is hot.
If you like that sort of thing.
But she is so mean to Owen. People are weird. They like being treated like shit. Oh.
Lord.
I really caught myself.
Yeah, you did. Put some pressure on that.
The knife is so sharp, I didn't even feel it.
Wrap it up.
Anyway, that's Owen's story, and there's more stuff, but I don't want to betray his trust.
Please, I totally understand.
Drinking a lot. Hard drugs.
Ooh.
I don't want to say which ones. It's like Percocet, Oxy, Molly. Drugs are no way to deal with your problems.
No. It sounds like you really care for Owen.
That is personal.
Just a habit. I ask a lot of questions. I used to be an investigative reporter.
I am not in love with Owen.
I never said you were.
You did?
No.
Oh.
It's funny you should say that. I haven't seen this movie yet, and I apologize for that. But it's very hard to find a good comedy, I guess, that speaks to you when you're over 35, at least in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Unless you're of a certain personality type, I guess. Every year, I think that the things that I thought were funny when I was 20 are less funny now, and it saddens me in some ways. Like I feel like the piece of me is gone. Like I'll go back and watch some of the comedies that I thought were hilarious when I was in college, and they're just terrible. They just don't hold up.
There's a season to everything, you know. And some of it is that it's a lot of that humor is mean spirited. And I think when you're young, you just, even if you think you're
racist or misogynist or just bad, like probably wasn't even funny then. Like you just overlooked it because the slapstick nature of it or the other things that made it funny.
There's a bit of that kind of comedy that is like, it's the shock value of it. Yeah. And eventually that doesn't
shock you anymore. Yeah,
that's right. And it does. And you have to keep increasing that shock value. And that's the problem with that kind of Apatow humor is that you keep having to go further and further and further. And so that makes the other stuff look tame. But then you get to a point where this is just literally obscene. It's not funny anymore. It's not shock. It's just obscenity.
So what's odd to me, though, is that I still find a lot of new sitcoms funny, like serial television. There's a lot of stuff that comes out new that's good for a laugh. I would say over the last 3 years, I've maybe seen two good newish comedies that have come out that I thought were actually funny as far as film goes.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like they're not writing humor that I think is interesting. It's just they're not putting it out on the big screen, I guess. I'm just kind of riffing off the top of my head.
I think it's just because what makes money and that 40-year-old virgin style humor is just, let's face it, it's cheap. It's easy to write. And there you go. And I say that as a fan of the 40-year-old virgin and was the Paul Rudd one with his best
role
friend. Role Models is another one. Yeah. And I even liked Dinner with Schmucks. Even though that was a remake. But
those are all 20 years old now. Like those are old.
Yes. Yes.
Name a movie in the last 5 years. let's start with that. Name any movie that was made in the last 5 years.
So it's like Trivial Pursuit. I'm awesome at older editions of Trivial Pursuit.
As long as it came out
Trivial Pursuit published in the past 5 years, I'm like, Miley Cyrus.
Yeah.
Check out Confess, Fletch. It's a fantastic film. John Hamm. So Fletch is a very charming asshole. And so John Hamm was born to play the role. he is very affable. He's the kind of guy that like insults you and you're like, oh man, I still want to be friends with that guy.
That's what we feel about you, honestly. That's
that's impossible because I'm not charming in the least.
And we don't want to be friends with him.
And I'm not handsome like John Hamm. John Hamm's like the most handsome man on the planet. And I think about that often.
While he's paying his bills.
I mean, John Hamm doesn't have to pay these bills. He just pays them in handsomeness. He smolders at the bills and they pay themselves. Well, Jason, do you have anything else that you want to talk about?
A more recent one, not as recent as Confess Fletch, but it's Knives Out by Rian Johnson. And the sequel to this is going to come out soon, not by the time of this recording. Glass Onion.
It did a limited release in, yeah.
It's playing locally. Yeah, it's playing now, actually.
So I think it'll be released on Netflix.
If you live in a place where people live, then there's.
If you live in a real city, you can go see Glass Onion.
I didn't want to say it like that, but.
Well, you know what I've got? There. You know what I've got? Fast food, Adam. That's what I've got. Knives Out is, you know, Rian Johnson's main modus operandi is deconstruction. Mm-hmm. And that's what this is. Like, you see what the crime is, essentially, at the beginning, and you see how it's done. The whole plot is that Christopher Plummer is, like, this wealthy patriarch of this family. Of course, got the jerkwad family. They're all after his money and everything. Mm-hmm. Famous cast, you know, Chris Evans, Jamie Lee Curtis, et cetera, et cetera. He's really fond of the nurse that's helping him out, and when she's giving him some medication, she knocks over the vials and she picks up the wrong one and gives him too much of it. And so it's a lethal dose. And he tells her, just go ahead and leave. But he knows it was an accident. She didn't do it on purpose. And he commits suicide to cover up the fact that she poisoned. And so that seems like that's the end of it. But someone has anonymously called in Daniel Craig's character, Benoit Blanc or something like that.
That's right, or something.
Yeah, Benoit Blanc. Daniel Craig in a very interesting Kentucky accent.
That sounds mildly insulting, Jason. That's an interesting take on a Southern accent you have there, sir.
Yeah. Well, remember what we said is a brick pit here.
He took voice acting lessons from Dick Van Dyke's teacher. That's
the guy that gave Dick Van Dyke the Cockney accent. Yeah. No, this is what all English people sound like.
Bluegrass State, I got you covered, man. No problem.
And he worked with Lady Gaga.
Jeez, no. Talking about Knives Out, man. Jason left nobody unmolested in that.
The whole thing is that he's brought in anonymously to find out what the real crime is here and who the murderer is and all that kind of stuff. It's kind of a reverse of your typical mystery film. And the fact that she's trying to hide the fact that she's guilty, but she can't lie. Like, she physically gets ill if she tries to lie. And so it's a bit amusing, like, how she's trying to, like, cover up and everything like that. But underneath it all, there's an actual mystery of who is the anonymous person that called him in and what is their motivation.
It is an immovable fact that I killed Harlan.
Yes, you did. Yes, he did. Yes, you are. But... I spoke in the car about the hole at the center of this donut. And what you and Harlan did that fateful night seems, at first glance, to fill that hole perfectly. A donut hole in a donut's hole. But we must look a little closer. And when we do, we see the donut hole has a hole in its center. It is not a donut hole, but a smaller donut with its own hole. And our donut is not a hole at all.
Monk, look, I understand that this is amusing for you.
Why was I hired? Why would someone hire me?
Someone fishing for a crime to reverse the will, Blanc.
Come on. I was hired before the sealed will was read, so yes. The person must have known the contents of the will. But one step further, that same person must have known a crime was committed. And further, if the intent was to reverse Marta's inheritance, they must have known that Marta was responsible. An intriguing combination of factors. Someone who knew what Marta did, wanted to expose it, but could not reveal how they knew.
Fran, she was blackmailing me. She knew what I did.
Yeah, but Fran wanted money. Ergo, she did not want the crime exposed.
Well, there's someone in the family had observed Marta doing something suspicious.
But they would have had no reason not to speak up. The answer is not so simple. Now, with the entire solution in my field of view, the arc of this case is a tragedy of errors. Marta, it will not be easy for you to hear. But there is at least one truly guilty party behind it all. Guilty in the true sense of acting with malice and committing a heinous crime with selfish intent.
And so it's a very fun kind of ride. It's a lot better deconstruction than he did of time travel with Looper.
Is it highbrow? Does it try to be highbrow? I mean,
Knives Out is kind of, I would actually say that, yes.
I wouldn't say it's highbrow. I mean, it's not lowbrow, but it is not haughty in its comedy.
See, I haven't watched the film in because the trailers reeked of Wes Anderson.
Oh.
It just seemed like it was kind of in that vein. If I'm incorrect, I mean, you know, that's it. Yeah, the trailers are meant to give you an idea of whether or not you want to see the film. I did not want to see it based on the trailers. Yeah.
I mean, so, this is very much Rian Johnson doing his Agatha Christie. This is his Hercule Poirot.
It's really good. I mean, my wife enjoyed it too.
So Josh should hate it.
It sounds like it.
I think the distinguishing feature between highbrow and lowbrow is highbrow comedy expects the viewer to have a basic level of knowledge. It'd be like inside jokes that only people who knew something about Shakespeare or knew something about art would get, you know,
like Guildenstern, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead.
Yes, that's exactly the perfect kind of joke that you either get it or you don't, right? That's it has a certain level of sophistication to it. I think Knives Out fits that. There's a lot of like subtlety to it that you'll either get or you won't. And that, you know, that may be why the way you described that, the Fletch movie, that it sounds like there's some stuff in there that maybe people just, the target comedy audience of 2022 doesn't understand.
Yeah. Like I said, it's a deconstruction. So yeah, there's a lot of aspects to it because Plumber's character is a mystery novelist.
Right.
And one of the main things is, and you've seen it in the trailers, like he has this big display of all these different knives.
And they are out.
Yes.
That's the joke, Josh.
See, it's too highbrow for me. I'm too stupid to understand this film.
We already knew that. You didn't.
I know. It's just so it is. Is it smarmy?
Yes. No.
Maybe.
Would I?
You wouldn't understand if it was.
Would I find it smarmy?
You find everything smarmy, so yes.
Yeah, that's a pretty smarmy answer, so yeah.
How droll.
Adam will never forgive me for saying that he was a droll one time. And like cut to the bone. Here we are on his deathbed, like, honey, I know we've raised two wonderful children. We've put them through college. They're great successes, but tell me, was I droll? And she'll cry and say yes.
In my always. New York Times obituary, it'll say, Adam, who was once described as droll, comma, passed away. That's what it's going to say.
A good time was had by all.
That's right. Many laughed.
So, I'm not going to give away the ending just in case you never decide to watch it, which you are. But if anyone else listening who hasn't watched it decides to watch it, you should. It's entertaining. It's a fun ride. If you're a fan of mysteries, mystery movies and mystery novels, there's a lot in here for you. It's a deconstruction of that, so play a lot with a lot of the tropes and everything.
you mentioned seeing the murder at first. That's typically in the realm of like official inspector whodunit does that a lot. Like Columbo always started with the actual murder. And so like the suspense is
him discovering.
How exactly is Columbo going to figure out how Johnny Cash killed that guy?
One more thing. We know he did it. I do that all the time. One more thing.
Nobody gets that.
Nobody
gets the most ubiquitous reference.
Nobody gets it. It is insane that it.
Yeah. It's probably because your Peter Falk is probably lacking.
Is that what it is?
Yes. Yeah, so
you gotta have a wonky eye.
And I'm always holding.
You sound nothing like Peter Falk. You sound like the guy at the McDonald's drive-thru. One more thing. Can I get some fries with that? Is the ice cream machine working?
You sound too sincere.
That's what it
is. Yeah, of course we couldn't put Columbo on this list because he is an actual
policeman.
But if you get a chance,
because he's an actual cop.
Yeah. Actually, he's not a cop.
Oh, that's true. He wants to get back his badge.
He wants to get back on the force.
The
Columbo. What I love about the Columbo mysteries is there was this thing. Network TV used to be a lot more experimental.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had movies of the week. So Columbo, even though it was a show, it was technically a movie of the week. You would have a Columbo murder mystery. It was like an hour and a half. And you would have the special guest star, Leonard Nimoy, Johnny Cash, you know, whoever else. And it was a bit of a spectacle as well as being kind of a fun mystery.
Mm-hmm. We kind of backed our way into this a little bit, but I just accidentally remembered Monk and Psych.
Yeah,
which are TV shows that I absolutely love.
We always forget like the elephants in the room. We're like, excuse me, Monk. We're talking about. this has nothing to do with you.
Well, TV detectives are so prolific.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, you know, everything in the 80s almost was a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Riptide and Hardcastle and McCormick, and you know, Simon and Simon. Love Simon and Simon.
The best theme songs ever.
Yes.
Put to record.
And you know, like I said, there were all these different investigators or whatever. Father Dowling,
Scarecrow,
you know,
Mrs. King,
that were, you know, they had their little gimmicks. You know, mm-hmm. It's a very, like I said, it's a very interesting genre because it's so broad.
I mean, hell, Pushing Daisies falls into this.
Back into Supernatural. Yeah,
yeah. While we're mentioning. Cops were like Kenneth Branagh.
We spent an hour rattling off a bunch of obscure movies from the 20s and 30s, and now we're like, oh yeah, what about all this good crap?
Kenneth Branagh's Wallander is
exceptional. Yeah. That is a great show.
And that's like the most depressing, captivating show ever that you will see because it's just like, you know, oh, Wallander's got diabetes. Damn. Like we watched it, the whole series, you know, kind of back to back, and like I'd be at work going, like, "What's Wallander going to do when his dad dies?" like his fake problems became my real world problems. Like, you know,
he was asking people at work that all the time. What's Wallander going to do when his dad dies? I don't know what you're talking about.
I had to take bereavement leave when his dad died. It was. TV dad died, so I'm going to take a couple of days off.
Bosch? He's a cop, right? He's an active duty
cop. I think he's a cop.
But all these good TV shows that
we forgot. The investigation is what Jason would call a super genre, I think, because there's a lot of different ways you can plug that into a mm-hmm. narrative. Mm-hmm. And we've explored only a fraction of them. So go to your local library and check out a Nero Wolf book and learn all about orchids and being fat.
but don't take my word for it.
In fact, I'm going to up the ante here. If you listen to this, you actually do send a picture of you holding a Nero Wolf book to our Facebook page, I will send you a $10 gift card.
Dude, you're about to be broke.
That's $30 right there.
Before the postage.
Can I do it?
No. You have to be a listener. It has to be before the end of January. And it's subject to no more than three listeners. I'll limit it to that. How's that? Does that make it sound good?
God. Kyle, it's no fun anymore.
We can't bankrupt Adam now.
I would have this on Twitter so fast, be like, let's bankrupt this dude.
So also subject to the laws and local regulations wherever you may be.
Boy, so what you need to do, people, is go to your local library, pick up a book, take a picture of it, and then put the book back on the shelf.
Just Photoshop it. Adam can't tell the difference.
That's true. What is Photoshop?
Well, on that note, on that exciting impromptu, and Adam really will do send you a $10.
I will.
He's that kind of guy. He's not a liar like me. I would say that all day long and then couldn't be bothered.
If you pick up his favorite book and take a picture of it, he'll kiss the envelope. So you have a nice little lipstick stain back there.
Each envelope will have a little dash of Chanel number 5 in his personal stamp.
That's right. I do have a personal stamp. That won't surprise anyone, I guess.
No.
That almost surprises me. Well, Adam, since you brought it up, why don't you tell everybody how they can get in touch with us and walk us on out. Walk us to the door with one more thing.
One more thing. So the best way to reach us is on our social media pages, Facebook and Twitter for the time being. If you want to email us, that you can do at brickedpit@gmail.com. And if you'd like to send us a voicemail or leave us some kind of other feedback, please go to anchor.fm/brickpit. Where you could do that, and we would love to play anything you have to say for us on the air. Until next time, we appreciate everyone who's listening, and happy holidays.
Oh, just one more thing, sir.
Josh was the murderer the whole time.